Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact... You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, welcome to a bit of a different Rahalastapa. This is a new era. It'll all be like this for the short term and maybe the long term, who knows. But this is a remote Rahalastapa. Rahalastapa, stop saying that, you people over there. With the wonderful Adam Buxton. We recorded it about 7 weeks ago, I think. And near the beginning of lockdown, or nearer the beginning of lockdown. We are now nearer the end of lockdown, but who knows when that will be. We're going to carry on doing these. We've done 5 or 6 already, and there will be more. We record them, and you can watch them live on Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. on twitch.tv/rkherring. There might be a couple of weeks I take off just because I'm writing a book at the moment, but tune in then. There's lots of other stuff on twitch.tv/rkherring, including morning stone clearing, evening snooker playing. Sunday nights, I'm watching films and doing director's commentaries, and you can watch along with the film at home. And we're playing a few video games and planning what other stuff we can get up to with a live broadcast on Twitch. You can subscribe to that, and if you're with Amazon Prime, you can give me £5 a month with no extra cost to yourself. You just have to link your accounts and then subscribe. Remember to come back each month and subscribe again. If you don't do it for me, please do it for someone on Twitch, because there's free money sitting in your account that you can give. Take it from me and Amazon and give it to someone who deserves it. I will use any money I get to churn back into making more podcast content for you. So, it's sad that we lost... lots of potentially fantastic live guests, but hopefully they will all return and we'll be doing stuff in the theatre again in the autumn. That's when some stuff's pegged to go back in, but we'll see. If not, we will keep providing content online and wait until we have the all clear to come out of our bunkers and be humans once again, whether that's in 5 months or 500 years. We will return. And last week wasn't a bad way to end. And certainly the week before with Michael Palin, at least we got that one in the bag. You know what I'm talking about.
Anyway, gofaststrike.com/badges if you want to just give us some money and get lots of stuff in return, lots of nice extras. Let's sit back, relax, and enjoy this slightly weird but rather charming and lovely. Who are all these people clapping? Rahalastapa with Sir Adam Buxton. Thank you very much. Hello! How are you doing? Welcome, welcome to the first ever live streamed Rahalastapa, which is answer Richard Herring's live streaming on Twitch podcast. You can't do that. But I was hanging around with myself in self-isolation, and I'm Rahalastapa, so I don't know if that's going to catch on. Welcome to the show. I don't have to do the thing about please welcome a man. It's very strange doing it without an audience, though there's lots of people saying Rahalastapa zooming by in the chat room. If you're listening to the podcast in a couple of months' time, hello. Hope the world is still here. You may be one of the ragbag of survivors. So because of the current situation in the world, we are starting to do... we had loads of Rahalastapas stored up in a big podcast silo and foolishly started giving them out 2 a week because we thought we'll never get through all these. Oh, how we regret that now. So we'll be doing one of these every Wednesday night on Twitch. It will then be released. You'll be able to watch it on Twitch for about a month, and then it'll be released in its turn as a genuine, regular Rahalastapa podcast, if this works, which it seems to be doing so far. That's very good news. 889 viewers in already. That's fantastic. We've already surpassed the... Well, we're nearly at the highest ever Rahalastapa live audience ever. Maybe that will happen as we go through. We surpassed the total. Very sad that we should have been doing Adam and Joe and Lolly Adafopi just 2 days ago. It's very sad to have missed those podcasts. They should hopefully all be rescheduled. We'll do our best. And also the Birmingham Podcast Festival and the Edinburgh Festival probably won't be rescheduled. I might try and do something from home. If you enjoy this, hey, you can become a badger, as you know. You can subscribe on Twitch. If you're an Amazon Prime member, you can subscribe without any cost to yourself and give us $5 every month if you want to. By linking your accounts, there's a video on my YouTube, Herring1967, that will explain all that. If you would prefer to not give any money, you have no money, that is fine too. If you prefer to give some money to charity, could you Google Just Giving Heckle the Virus and you can donate some money to help all the club comedians who are currently unable to work and have suddenly lost all their work and... we've got up to about £85,000 with that fund, but that is enough to last 8 weeks. So we do need some more. Well, it's all very exciting. We're self-isolating. It's been nice to spend time with the kids and also a living hell to spend time with the kids. It's the worst thing ever. This morning, though, I'm in the countryside. It feels a bit like a sort of rural idyll, and it's nice to be with the family all the time. And we've been playing Annie in the breakfast. My daughter loves the soundtrack to Annie. And the sun will come out tomorrow. Tomorrow is a very inspirational song that's been helping us through, especially this morning when they sang Bet Your Bottom Dollar and my daughter went bottom and laughed and my son laughed. And I thought everything's going to be okay. if we're still laughing at that, we'll be fine. The news today is that men in their 50s and 60s are the most susceptible new demographic to get the virus and die. So I'm delighted about that. I also sort of think, this is really bad news for us because I was getting quite fit till we were all locked down and now I'm just drinking beer and not exercising. And so we'll have about 2 months of this, and just as the virus is most virulent, it will hit us and we'll all be killed. It'll wipe out. It'll be like the Pied Piper of Hamelin, but of middle-aged men. And maybe it's good. Maybe we should all die. I've been married for 8 years yesterday. Sorry, I didn't do any snook yesterday. I was disappointed in the whole of that 7th year of marriage. I didn't get a 7-year itch at all. Just gone to the 8-year weeping sores straight away. But I guess that's a sign that I'm in love or something. I don't know. That's good, isn't it? What else was I going to talk about? I was worried about money. I've had to cancel so many gigs and sort of ostentatiously gave away loads of money because I thought I've got that O2 gig coming up, which hopefully will be rescheduled, but I haven't heard anything from them. I was getting paid well for that gig, so I thought I'll give that money to the Heckle the Virus thing. Then that got cancelled like the day before. I mean, on the day, I think it was. But luckily, on Friday the 20th of March, I got an email that says, this is official notice of unclaimed fund of $10.5 million left by Mr. Herring, who died in a car crash. Upon your positive response, I will make all the information known to you once I confirm your willingness. Regards, Mark. So that was good news. So I've got 10.5 million coming in from a guy. It's a formal letter, but he's very informal, Mark, isn't he? Just signing Mark. I think he's trying to get in with me so that when I get the money, I'll give some of it. But I'm not going to fall for that, mate. It's my money and I'm going to enjoy. I'm not gullible, mate. I'm not going to give you the money just because you're trying to be my mate. I'm a bit concerned. It just says 10.5 million. It doesn't say 10.5 million of what? I think it might be 10.5 million trim phones. We will see. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed Off Menu. You can still catch that on the Off Menu feed and also the Cosmic Shambles video feed on YouTube. Bella's pudding caused a lot of consternation. It's a real thing. I didn't make it up. It was April the 1st. I've been playing Football Manager on here, Snooker on here. Kevin Toms, who created Football Manager, has been watching me play Football Manager, which is one of the most surreal things I've ever experienced. You know, imagine the 14-year-old me knowing that one day the man who created the game I was playing would be watching me playing it. What would be the worst thing that you could have the person you were thinking of watching you do? No, let's move on. We'll think of some more emergency questions as we go. Subscribe if you want to. Follow me. We've got currently, as we speak, 4,882 followers. We might get up to 5,000. And we've got 1,522 viewers. It's the highest ever viewership for an episode of Rahalastaba. So thank you very much for that. Hopefully more will come in. Do subscribe. Do follow me at least. If you can afford to pay money, you can pay money. If you want to do it via Amazon Prime, it's free money. Tell your friends. We'll be here every Wednesday evening. But my guest tonight, he's probably best known as the ghost of Prince Quintus in Stardust, which I don't think I've ever talked to him about before, which I can't believe. Will you please welcome a man I was meant to be talking to with another man on Monday. It's Adam Buxton. Here he is. There he is.
Hey.
Can you hear me, Adam? Hello.
How are you doing, man?
I'm very good. How are you? This is exciting, isn't it?
It is exciting, yes. Modern technology. We thought it was a bunch of shit. We thought all it did was enable disgruntled, disaffected, angry losers on the internet. Wrong! It enables middle-aged, soon-to-die geniuses like ourselves to produce important broadcasts like this one to keep the nation's peckers up.
I think so. Well, I wanted you to do the first one because I thought who better to cheer everyone up than Adam Buxton. So hopefully you will. We won't just. Are you worried about the? You know, I wasn't that worried about it. And then when Boris Johnson got seriously ill, I thought, oh fuck, this could actually get me. Are you worried now? You're 50 now, aren't you, Adam?
I am 50. Yeah, I'm 51. In the zone. I'm in the danger zone. Yep. I don't know. I feel I've been through the thinking that you've got the symptoms phase.
Of course.
And have you had the thing of kind of breathing and thinking, oh, that's a little painful. That's painful.
No, I haven't had that yet. I was a bit ill when it all started up. I had some kind of bug off the kid. So I was like, right. Oh God.
That's the thing is that there's loads of bugs around anyway. So it's so hard to tell like which one is which. Everyone is desperate to reach the point where you can take the test and find out if you had it or not. You know, the dream scenario is, oh, actually you did have it and you just toughed it out. It didn't even affect you.
Yeah.
Fuck you, coronavirus. But but you should we say at the top here that, should we say a serious thing about how seriously we take it and how grateful we are to the frontline workers and all that kind of thing? And then hope that will get us off the hook if we are then from then on flippant and inappropriate about the entire situation.
Well, I'm disappointed there hasn't been an 8 o'clock clap for the podcasters of the world, like out on the doorstep.
We're not doing the clap. We should be doing the clap. Everyone else has finished doing the clap.
Oh, it's too late. Was that for Boris? You made me clap for Boris Johnson. Or was that for the
NHS?
I'm happy.
Haven't you been praying for him all day?
I feel, you know, I want to get to the point where we're able to go make the joke of, I wish he had died when he had the coronavirus. That is what I'm sort of hoping for. But I'm very upset. I'm hoping he'll go through it all, survive, and then go, oh, the NHS is really good. We should be much nicer to them than we were planning to be. They're pretending they're going to be nice to them anyway. So
I confidently predict that he is going to be absolutely fine. I confidently predict, boy, maybe this is a stupid confident prediction.
Yeah, but it's coming out.
I confidently predict that he is, as we speak, watching a box set, propped up on pillows, checking his Twitter feed, catching up on some reading, and having a nice little break. And, you know, because they haven't intubated him or anything like that, have they? I think he's in.
Well, they're saying that, but I think they're like that. I mean, you know, this is going to come out in the podcast stream in a couple of months, so they will know at home. My fear is that he'll die on Good Friday and then come back alive on Easter Sunday. And he is the new Jesus. That is my worry. That's my main worry.
Yeah.
So out of all the scenarios, that is the worst thing that can happen. But if he is Jesus, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. But yeah. I don't want him to die. I hope he survives. But I'm more scared for myself as a middle-aged man. I was thinking, quite good to get it. Just get it, like you say, get it over with. But now, I'm sort of thinking I probably don't want that to happen.
No, the random factor, the not knowing how you will respond to it is a frightening aspect.
Yeah.
But it's quite...
Well, if you die, Adam will still put this out as a tribute to, I'll do an intro at the front where I kind of hold a picture of you and go, it's very sad to say Adam Buxton. And if you would do the same for me.
Yeah.
If you could do that.
We'll have an amazing charity show. All the comedians of the UK and all the finest comedians all across the world will come together and sing your praises and say lines that you did, and we'll play back times when you offended people and said the wrong thing. Stephen Merchant will give a very tearful speech about how you were an edgy genius. Hey, look. I'm going to this is a radical change of subject.
Yeah, go for it. Let's talk.
Yorkshire Tea made me some customized tea, like bespoke.
Hold it a bit further over because you're not quite in the middle of the camera. Put it in front of your face. Dr. Buckle's tea? No way.
Yeah. And I think they sent it to me back in the day when maybe they hoped I would tweet it or something like that. But I always feel a bit queasy when people do things like that, when they send you stuff and they're obviously hoping that you will tweet it. And so I didn't, but I do love it. And I do love Yorkshire Tea. And I thought this might, and now I'm not on Twitter. So I thought, well, this will be a good opportunity to just tick all those boxes, show off that they made me some personalized tea.
You haven't opened it yet. Are you going to drink the tea?
Well, we'll see how things go. I mean,
each tea bag might be made from your flaked skin or something like that. It might be, or at least have your face. It'd be great if it was just the tea, just face made a sort of Adam Buxton face with a beard on it as every time you dunked it.
Oh no,
that's got to be possible.
You're right. It does say it's made from my flaked skin. Fuck. No, I don't want much. Anyway, that's quite good, isn't it? Personalized.
That
tea.
That is pretty good.
They haven't sold out of tea. I mean, tea. There's been like tea supplies are okay at the shops. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, nearly everything's back to normal. I went before, and obviously, toilet roll inexplicably disappeared, and flour. But flour has not come back.
That's
the one thing. Flour and fish fingers, which I can understand. Everyone's just buying fish fingers for their kids. All that sort of bits are empty. But flour, there was... When I went to get eggs before it all happened, I was in Waitrose in Hitchin. And the only pack of eggs there were was one pack of quail's eggs, which is the most it's the most Hitchin thing I've ever seen. But that still meant that all the other quail's eggs had gone. There are now eggs there, but no flour. Everyone's turned into a baking... British Bake Off champion. I don't know if everyone's thought we'll make our own food from scratch.
What about the chocolate situation?
Chocolate's fine, but I don't eat chocolate. I've stopped eating chocolate and I don't eat chocolate anymore. But the supplies for that are low because I buy it for the kids. Everything was fine. I tried to buy four bottles of 500 milliliter Diet Coke, and I had to put one back because they were limited to three. That was the only thing I got caught out on.
How does it work then with Do they define what essential items are? I haven't actually been to the supermarket since the lockdown began.
How are you living?
Well,
how are you eating?
My wife, she goes. So she does it. I think she likes doing it because she gets to go out of the compound and, you know, queue up and see other human beings.
And you're sort of a hero for risking your life going out there, but you are then risking everyone else's life by returning home. You should be the person who goes to the supermarket is locked down for 14 days.
Mate, she goes through quite a lengthy detox procedure when she gets back. I swear, I shouldn't be saying this probably, but she doesn't bring the bags into the house. She leaves them outside the house, and then she transfers each item into like a bin, and then she hoses down the bin, and then she wipes everything with sanitary wipes and stuff. And then, I mean, it's like she thinks that Chernobyl's happened or something. But maybe
it's sensible, though.
It is.
That's
sensible.
How it's going to get in. That's the only way it's going to get in post deliveries or so. But you know, it's so
hard. Are they not
hard,
taking any
that?
Precautions at the supermarket at all? Or is, I mean.
But then people come and I went, you know, I go in and you touch something and they go, oh, no, I'll have that one. You know, you pick something up and then you put it down. Everyone does that subconsciously.
Everyone does that.
It's like I totally touch my face all the time. I can't stop doing that. I was doing the keypad and I was like, I just thought, the minute I touched the keypad to pay for my food. So, you know, it's just last time I took a big bottle of hand sanitizer in my pocket. That was what I decided to do to kind of.
No, you're right. You're right. Now I think,
but that's where you're going to get caught out. We can't get caught in. They can't get into the house without someone bringing it in on a package or from outside, from the outside world. So, you know, we're safe as long as we stay inside.
Yes. No, you're right. You're right. Now that I think of it, when I go to the supermarket, I sneeze, I drool, I lick all the cereal. I kiss the woman at the checkout or the guy. I'll just kiss the checkout person. And there's a lot of saliva. So it's just as well that I'm not doing the shop. We ran out of toilet paper ages ago, though. So
did you?
Yeah. I've been just every morning. One of the routines now is I use the jet washer. Everyone lines up, bends over and jet wash low, you know, on a low setting. Otherwise, it's just mayhem. But that's a good routine. What about, have you got any good new routines, lockdown routines?
Oh, man, I'm just finding it so. We're trying to work in ways that we can work and do some writing and look after the kids. It's just awful having to look after your kids all the time.
Yeah, because
how
old are yours?
5 and 2. So the 5-year-old was at school, which was helpful. And the 2-year-old, we had help and my mother-in-law would come over. And, you know, you realize how much help you had. And so to not have any of that at all, and you're still trying to work, I'm just so tired and drinking to excess to get
drinking
over it. It's a beautiful thing. It's lovely. And I think I was thinking this morning, you sort of start feeling, I understand the spirit of the Blitz, and I'm not comparing it to the Blitz in any other way, but you understand how people look back at the Blitz and thought, oh, but it was a happy time though, because we did this and this, because you're closer. And even as things are happening, you're thinking, once this is over, I'm going to look back at my daughter laughing at Bet Your Bottom Dollar, and I'm going to really love that memory if I'm still alive. If not, I'll leave a little video for her saying, remember that, and she can enjoy it. So, you know, I think you understand that. You're almost in the moment feeling the nostalgia for what you're doing. So loads of it is, we're living in the country as you are, and it's kind of idyllic and it's fine. It's not that different than my real normal life, to be honest.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's only when you look at the news that everything suddenly slides into perspective. And you can't, I mean, it's hard not to, well, you're always reminded of how lucky you are and how grim it would be if your situation was different, if you didn't like where you were living, if you were living with people you didn't want to be with, if you were living with someone scary. I mean, God, there's so many ways it could just be unbearable. And
I just think of all, you know, even like when we moved to this house, we just had a son, our baby, everything was half built. And, you know, I just think if it had happened then, it would have been, and we had a terrible 4 or 5 months where things went wrong. And if it had happened then, it would have just been the end of us, I think, like literally.
Yeah.
And I was thinking if it happened in the 90s when I lived on my own and, you know, and there wasn't even a proper internet to help you out, really, it would have been just... So for the people like that, so the nice thing I think is there is the internet, there is stuff to do, you can talk to people and interact with people. But yeah, I mean, if you were dating, if you were, you know, if you were not in a relationship, but if you want to have sex in the next 3 months, what are you going to do? You can't just wank all the time. I mean, that's what you'd have to do, Adam. It's like it'd be like being married. You'd have to wank all the time. But I was like, that's the other thing. Now, for 6 months, married people, on average, are having slightly more sex than single people.
Are they?
And that is the I would say so, because the single people are having no sex, and somewhere married couples are it just takes one married couple to have sex once in the next 2 months, and we'll have had more sex than the single people.
Yes,
I reckon I can do that in the next 2 months. That's my boast.
How about arguments? Have you had, what kind of things have you argued about? Have you argued with your partner?
It hasn't been as bad. I think we're arguing less. We always argue. Like, you know, we always get the frustration of just the tiredness gets to us. And we have had one or two, but actually everything's become a lot calmer as a result of this. It's kind of weird.
Have you argued about things in the news?
Not too badly. Have you been arguing about that? What have you argued about?
Yeah, no, I mean, low-level stuff. It's all been fairly harmonious, actually. It's all like,
yeah,
as you say, it's like, God, it feels like, wow, we went nice. We made a good decision here. And I like my children most of the time.
Yeah.
And my wife is great. And I just think she's terrific. The only time that she has made me a little bit sad is she's just discovered WhatsApp and sort of social networking and messaging apps. And now all her buddies are in constant contact, sending her memes. And so she's just, and as far as I can tell, most of them come from the Daily Mail online. So she's just got this nonstop Daily Mail online meme feed, which is making me a bit sad.
Okay.
Some of them are quite good. Have you seen the Irish girl saying, "I'm six. Why can't I go to the pub? Why won't you let me go to the pub? I'm six."
I haven't seen many memes.
That's a good one. I mean, that's not a coronavirus one. I don't know where that one came from. But she's very charming. A humorous young woman who is six and very indignant that she is not allowed to go to the pub. And what are the other ones? There's a coronavirus one of a guy, a sort of sexy guy dancing around with his top off. And then it's after the lockdown and it's a fat guy dancing around with his top off.
Yeah. My mother-in-law has started. That's the only thing that's happened. WhatsApp, my mother-in-law started forwarding humorous things. And I miss her so much, mainly for the childcare, that I have to pretend I enjoy all of them and everything she sends. But I think she has sent me that one, yet, so I have seen a few memes.
We didn't argue about that, but I was a bit shitty about it. I just said, like that was in the first week of lockdown, and I said something like, oh, Jesus, I hope you don't show me these memes every day of the lockdown. But I said it in quite a shitty way. And so that was there was some tension there. And then we had from nowhere this ridiculous conversation at supper about why are Sweden doing things so differently?
Okay.
And she said, like, isn't it weird that Sweden are just taking a totally different approach to the whole thing? And and maybe I was in a bad mood or something, but I just said, no, it's a totally different country. They do loads of things different there. The society is structured in a totally different way. It's not comparable. They can do things their own way if they like. Anyway, it sort of degenerated from there.
I think it'd be better if every country did handle it in a different way, and then we could find out the best way to handle it. That's the thing. So I think every country should say, I'm choosing total lockdown. I'm choosing everyone still goes out. And then we would see which was the best way, whether it's herd, the herd immunity would work.
No, that's no good. See whether... There's too many variables. That's the thing. It's like...
All the islands could do it. So if all the islands said, right, we could say we're going to do herd immunity and see what happens.
The only way to do that experiment is to do it with centre parks. See how all the different centre parks do it. Have a community lockdown within each centre parks in the UK. And then see how it spreads within the lodges.
Okay. Well, it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see, you know, how people of the future who are listening to this in the near future do with that. But let's move on. Let's talk about something else.
Okay.
Let me get my glasses. I've got to wear reading glasses.
Can we come back to it, though? I love coronavirus.
Of course we will. Of course we will.
I love chatting about it.
As my first guest, you are. This is what I wanted. This is the worst thing that's happened to me this year out of everything. The worst thing is I was going to have a really good year, especially end of March. Everything was really kicking off. I had a really good TV thing that was happening, and I had loads of gigs and big gigs. and I was going to earn quite a lot of money, and then everything shut down. So that was bad. I started the year going, everything's going to be fine. I'm having a great year. So that's bad. But the worst thing that's happened to me this year is I realized that my mind's eye is blind. I have a blind mind's eye. Do you know about this? There was a thing on Facebook a few weeks ago where it asked you to visualize an apple in your mind. If you close your eyes and visualize an apple, you see like a very three-dimensional, lovely colored apple? Do you see a two-dimensional colored apple? Do you see a two-dimensional black and white apple? Do you see a very blurry sort of apple? Or do you see nothing?
Mate, it's HD jazz apple. It's turning in 360 degrees. I've taken a bite out of it. I can see the bite now. It's delicious. Yeah. It hasn't been dropped. There's no bruising. There's no soft part. Yeah, so all functioning correctly in the mind's eye.
I see nothing.
Really?
If I think of an apple, I just think of the word apple. I can't see an apple.
What about if you think of genitals? Is that better?
No, I tell you what, I was trying to do it because obviously, like, if I'm thinking of someone's face, right? Yeah. If I'm trying to remember something of someone's face. But it's very upsetting. I had no idea that I had this mental disability. It is really. If I think of someone's face, what happens is I kind of get a flash of it, but it's like if you got a flash on your retinas, you would sort of have the vague image. It's like the image is sort of behind my head. I can sort of think, let's think of Adam Buxton, and I go, I can't see him, but I can sort of work it out from there. I don't see you unless I'm looking at you. Now I'm looking at you, but I have no mind's eye.
What is that? Is that memory? Are you not? You don't have good visual recall?
I mean, it's not even memory. It's just I can't. If I close my eyes, I don't see anything. Everything in my head is in an internal monologue. If I think of an apple, I'm just thinking of what an apple is like, but I can't see it.
Maybe you're overstimulated visually, and if you were on a desert island or in a blank room, like in a dark room or something, do you meditate?
No. Because there's no point, because I can't see anything in my mind. If they hadn't told me, I wouldn't have known about this. And now I know about it, I'm just bereft.
Right.
But I can't. Because I sort of think, like, well, when you imagine, say you were imagining a past sexual encounter, Adam, with someone who wasn't your current partner.
I believe it's known as the wank bank.
I can't. No, I don't. I don't see anything. I don't actually see anything. That's right.
You don't have
dreaming. I see stuff.
So you don't have an account in the wank bank.
I don't. Well, I thought I did, and I thought maybe it's just in the that I've used pornography so much that I can't think of anything now. Maybe it's sort of wiped. It's like an etch a sketch, and it's broken. And however much I shake it, I can't get anything back again.
Yeah, exactly.
But
it's wiped.
It's really bad. Well, it's weird to find out at 52 that you've got a disability that you didn't know about. I'm hoping I can have a parking space. I've been trying to get the parking spaces for a long time, but I don't know if you'll get one for that. So you've got the prop because it's a graded thing, and loads. I've met several people who, like me, can't do it. I hope the people at home are doing this as well now and trying to work out whether they can see things in their heads.
What do you think about when you go to sleep, like just before you fall asleep? Aren't you forming images in your mind then?
Well, they're not images. I'm thinking all the time. I mean, some people have no internal monologue. That terrifies me. Some people don't think in words at all.
What do they do? Just noises?
I guess just they only see things, I guess, but they'd have no voice in the head narrating. Mm. I've got a voice that narrates.
Yeah, that's sort of what my internal monologue is like. A lot of the time. I mean, fair enough. But I've got a very words.
So I guess my brain is just telling me, I think the minute I fall asleep, I see stuff. And the minute when I'm half asleep, I see stuff. I just see stuff in my dreams, but I just can't bring anything to mind.
I bet you can't visualize how you would respond if BT sent you a new look bill. Well, luckily, I've got a leaflet that shows you.
Yeah. My bill has a new look.
Your bill has a new look. And here's what it looks like when two people see their bill. So this lady's saying, how do you feel now that your BT bill has a new look? She's saying, oh, it's just such a surprise and great. And it's made me happy. And I just feel so hopeful now that the bill has a new look.
It's great, isn't it? BT. Yeah. That's what that leaflet's doing.
Good. I'm worried about everything now. I worry about everyone being that. Every time I see anyone that close, I just worry about them catching the coronavirus. So you can't. Yeah. You can't enjoy it. It's weird. It's changed the world. Maybe no one will ever touch each other again.
You know, I've been thinking about that. I do think that, you know, in China, the face masks, people wearing face masks has been part of that culture for many years. Not everybody used to wear them, but you would see people in China with face masks. And I wonder if it'll be more like that here now. And yeah, the idea of sort of going to a sweaty party and dancing around and kind of draping your arm around someone and just, I think I would think twice about doing that now. Not that I ever did it very often in the olden days anyway. But I think I would be quite, like, what about after a gig and doing selfies and things like that?
Yeah, well, I thought, because I was, literally I did, which we might talk about later, I did my final live Rahel Estepa. And I went out and did all the signings and stuff, and it was still just at that point. I was thinking, oh, you know, do we have to be careful? Everyone was laughing about it. I went for a meeting 2 days later. Everyone was sort of still shaking hands, going, "Oh, we were meant to do that." And then suddenly, by the time the next, you know, within that week, by Monday, we were cancelling all the rest of the gigs and that thing. So yeah, I did sort of think about that when I was thinking I was going to do the Monday gig. I thought, am I going to go out and sell merch and sign merch, or will that be weird? Or so yeah, all those things completely change, because you know I'm happy for people. These nerds who watch this stuff, they all come up and hug you, don't they? Did they do that to you?
Yeah, they like hug you.
I enjoy it.
I like hugging people, and I like kissing people. If I get the opportunity, I'll kiss them.
Okay.
And so I don't do that. Have you? No. Okay. Yeah, that is a shame. I spoke to my mum. She's out in Reading, and she's on her own. So,
of course, yeah.
I am a bit worried about her. I think she's finally, you know, getting the measure of the situation. She was in denial for quite a long time. She lives in a small village, and she was saying, I wish this... I'm looking forward to this crisis. Well, it's not really a crisis, is it? Ending. And I said, yeah, it is, Mum, it is a crisis. It's an actual crisis. And she said, well, yes, okay. I mean, I don't like it. It's not very, it's all a bit depressing. And I go for my walk down by the river, and I'm allowed to go for a walk. So I go for my walk. And in before, people used to look at you and say hello, and now people don't even look at you.
I know.
I felt bad for her.
Everyone's been much more friendly, I think. I live in quite a friendly village anyway, but everyone's been really supportive and nice here. That's what you go on a walk and everyone's like, oh, hi, how you doing?
Yeah,
my dog's been attacked. My dog's not coping well with that. My dog's having the worst time of everyone. She usually gets walked at lunchtime with a load of other dogs by a dog walker in the village. I think she's really missing that. But she's just started. If she's off the lead, she'll just start just going too violently for other dogs. So we've got to keep on. She's never done that before. So that's really weird. But apart from that, everyone's been very nice. Apart from our dog attacking their dogs.
Yeah.
Everyone's been very nice.
I literally haven't seen anyone apart from my family for 3 weeks, apart from the post delivery person.
Right. Are you going out? Are you walking? Have you got a big enough garden to walk your dog around the garden, or do you take your dog, take Rosie out?
We're out in the middle of a load of fields, so we're very lucky, and we can just walk along the fields, and we don't see anyone. Like we never see anyone anyway. And it's where I go and record my intros and outros for the podcast. And the reason, if you listen to the podcast, that I'm able to shout as loudly as I do at the end of each podcast and say "I love you, bye," is that there's no one around. I never see anyone. So we're lucky. We can kind of come and go as we please. And
so are you going out more than once? Are you doing more than once a day walking around, or are you?
I mean, it works out that it's generally once. And then the rest of the time, you know, do a few press ups and then go out with Rosie. My mission is to be able to pogo round the house. My wife bought some pogo sticks. Have you ever done pogoing?
My brother did it when I was a kid, and I was in deep, but he was a bit older than me, and I was in a lot of admiration of him, but I was too young to be able to do it, and then I never learned to do it.
So it's a living nightmare. It's the worst. My dad, when my dad was alive, and he used to review music videos for the Adam and Joe show, and one of the videos he reviewed was Supergrass, Late in the Day. And I don't know if you remember that video. It's them all on pogo sticks going around London. Yeah. And my dad just got a bee in his bonnet about that video. And he said, why are they on pogo sticks? It's absurd. It's utterly absurd. I was like, Dad, it's a music video. It's just sort of fun. It's that the director just thought, well, it kind of fits in with a bouncy feel of the track. It's the worst form of transport ever invented, he said. That was his main objection, was that it wasn't a good form of transport, so why would you have it in a video? But he's right. It is absolutely shit as a form of transport. Yeah. And also, it's not fun because it requires so much energy and coordination that it's absolutely exhausting. Within about three bounces, especially if you're 50 years old and not especially fit, you're ready to have a coronary. So my mission is to be able to get around the whole house without toppling off the pogo stick.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's good to have something to aim for. I just don't feel, I'd like to think I would achieve something while I'm in lockdown, but I'm really not. I'm finding it very difficult to do anything other. Your kids are a bit older, but are you homeschooling your kids? Or are they just getting on with it themselves?
No. The thing is, my two boys are, one of them was going to do his GCSEs and the other one was going to do his A-levels.
Right.
And so, you know, that whole situation is still up in the air. They don't really know what they're going to do. I have a vague feeling that they're going to reopen the schools before September. I can't believe that they're going to remain closed until then. I think, for all sorts of reasons, to give people a break, to get the economy going a little bit more. And I don't know. I feel as if maybe they'll go back. But then if they do, it'll be weird. Like, it's hard to know what the teachers would actually teach them now that they've had all this time off and the exams are completely up the spout. Because at the moment, the idea is that they're going to be assessed and assessed on their coursework plus the mark they got in the mocks. Right. But one of my children didn't do well in his mocks. Actually, and he said, he was saying to us, like, when he did incredibly badly, we were saying, why did you do quite so badly? Is there something emotionally up that we should know about? And he's like, no, I'm fine. The reason I did badly was that I just didn't revise. So we're like, oh, yeah, you've got to revise. That's the thing about exams. Pro tip. You have to revise, and then you do much better when you revise. He's like, yeah, I'm going to do that for the real ones. So that's not going to happen now. And they're going to get this weird assessment, and then you're going to, like, the older one's got a weird assessment for his A-levels, and then he has to apply to university off the back of that. Anyway, so that's all a bit weird and stressful. Yeah. And now that it's officially Easter holidays, we're ignoring it.
Well, we're ignoring it now. It's Easter holidays, but it is, you know, it's quite, I mean, it's only my daughter, obviously, but then you're trying to teach someone to read, and it's not very full on. She's five, but then there's a 2-year-old running around trying to get involved in everything as well. So it's incredibly stressful and very difficult. We were trying to do half a day on and half a day off so we could work. Like, if we were doing them, we'd flip it round. I'd do morning, my wife would do the afternoon, but we just got no work done. So now we're doing a day on, a day off. But then the day on, would looking after the kids, even without the schooling, is just so hard. So I'm so tired today. So it's just really, the idea of doing anything like reading a book, anything, you can't even leave the kids for more than a minute, you know. So you've got to be in the room with the little one. Yesterday, I kind of basically tuned out. They were watching The Little Mermaid, and I knew he was doing something, but I thought, oh, it's fine. And I was watching The Little Mermaid, and he was behind the sofa, and he'd pulled a table over, climbed up the bookcase, and pulled down my daughter's little, she was growing pea shoots in a little fairy garden. He pulled it down and thrown it, and I hadn't seen any of this, thrown it clump by clump all over the floor, and then throwing the whole thing upside down to the floor. And then I went, I said, what are you doing? He said, don't worry, Daddy, it's only soil. thought, and he was so like innocent about it. And I was thinking, my wife is absolutely going to murder me. She's been working on this thing with my daughter, and it's entirely my fault. So, because I'd taken my eye off the ball. I was in the same room as him, but I'd taken my eye off the ball.
And then did you say to your wife, "It's okay, it's only soil."
I just knew I had to go right and go, this is entirely my fault. He was very upset when he was, you know, I knew everything that I should have done, but I'd slacked back for 10 minutes and it was a bad thing. So, you know, but then it could be worse, couldn't it? You slack back for 10 minutes and then you go, oh, what's where? Oh, he's put his fingers in the plugs. Oh, well, we've got another one.
No,
It's been very difficult.
I'm very, very grateful that ours are all old enough to sort of look after themselves during the day. And that's left me time to do all my projects. I've written two and a half screenplays. I've written a very good play about a middle-aged man on lockdown, and he finds a portal to another dimension behind the booze. That's already been nominated for several major awards. And I'm learning Chinese, and I am becoming very fit, and I'm volunteering for the NHS. I've got the app, the Good Sam app.
Yeah.
And I'm going out and helping people. And
that's very good.
And I've been recording my audiobook.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So,
of course you have. Yeah, so your book. Well, let's talk about your book, The Ramble Book. So what is The Ramble Book? Is it an autobiography? Is it just...
No, I think it's called a memoir. So I think the difference between an autobiography and a memoir, as far as I am aware, is autobiography is your whole life, all the exciting things you've done. But as I haven't done that many exciting things, and you know, it's not like, oh, I can't wait till he gets to that bit about the persuasionists or whatever.
I can't wait to get back. That's the bit I'm looking forward to the most.
Well, no, this is about... It's mainly about growing up in the 80s. It's sort of a forensic series of reminiscences about my adolescence and making friends with Joe and the music I was listening to and the movies we were watching and formative cultural influences. And then juxtaposed with that, the other main motif is my relationship with my dad, who, for those who don't know, was in our TV show, the TV show I did with Joe Cornish on Channel 4 in the 90s. And then he died a few years ago. And so when he died, I realized that it was quite a weird relationship that I had with him in some ways. I mean, not weird, just quite formal. I think like a lot of people of a certain generation and perhaps a certain class, there's a kind of weird... formality. I was always envious of people who got on so well with their parents, you know, and wanted to call them every day and chat and laugh with them and tell, you know, share secrets. And I never, ever had that relationship with my parents. All I wanted them to do was go away. I wanted them to give me what I wanted and enable me to do everything I wanted. But there was no sort of close bond. And my theory is that that's probably because they sent me to boarding school. And I think one of the prices you pay for being sent to boarding school is not really ever having that same close relationship with your parents again. I'm sure that's not true for everyone. I'm sure some people are fine with it. But I think that's what happened to me. Anyway, so the book is like a hopefully funny series of ramblings about my dad, my relationship with him, what it was like when he came to live with us when he was ill, and looking after him, and then stuff about my own family and stuff about Joe and friends and all that kind of stuff.
Cool. It sounds good. So you've been doing the audiobook. That last week you were recording the audiobook. So you're doing that in your, where you're doing that there? Were you doing that at home?
Yeah, I've been doing that right here in my nutty room. And
I listen to a lot of audiobooks.
Oh, yeah.
I like that. I like the fact that I've been asking this as an emergency question, so I'll ask you this. I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and it's a real privilege to get to hear the author reading their own work when it's the actual author doing it. If you could have any book from history or from all time before they started doing audiobooks, probably read by the author, who would you like to hear read a book?
Are we imagining that they are going to be any good at reading it?
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe or maybe not. You know, I mean, Charles Dickens probably would be pretty good because he used to do those stage shows of his own books, didn't he? So he'd be, I'd be very interested to hear Charles Dickens because I would like to know if he's good or if he was a bit hammy and
because you never know,
he was good.
Charles Dickens might have had a very clicky mouth, or he might, you know, there's all manner of quite distracting and irritating vocal tics.
Yeah. Yeah,
That you get with audiobooks. I downloaded one the other day, and I won't say who it is. I'm just trying to scan forward in this anecdote to check for potential problems that I'm going to start doing that. But there, it's like quite a serious, sad memoir about someone who loved their mum and then she got ill and died. And it's all about the process of grieving for this guy's mum. And it was written by someone roughly our age, same sort of social background or whatever. And the guy they got to read the audiobook is just nothing like the fellow that wrote it whatsoever. It sounds as if they got a sort of aging thesp to read the audiobook, and he reads it. So it's all just stuff like he reads it in this voice like this. And so he's talking about his mother and saying she used to bake the most marvelous cakes. And I would come into the kitchen and say, "Mum, I love your cakes." And it's just going full on with the SB read. And it just completely destroys it. I had to stop reading it after a while.
Yeah.
For a bit, it was fun. It was quite good. I was seeing my mates more and more often in those days and feeling very excited about the prospect of getting it together with my new girlfriend. I don't know. I'm not doing justice to the actual text, but it was, it's all that sort of pitch of
when it's wrong, it's interesting. When the wrong person's doing something, it's really interesting. Or just for you sometimes, isn't it, that some of them I just find impossible, especially with a novel. Sometimes you'll really get into it and sometimes it's like impossible to get into it. I was listening to John Malkovich do Breakfast of Champions, which is great. He's just like the way he's very John Malkovich in it, and it sort of fits it very well. I had Michael Palin, which we'll talk about some of the guests you've had on. We had Michael Palin finally on Rehelliscor, and that's the only good thing that's happened this year. If that had been cancelled as well, I think that would have been just so upsetting, because that was the most exciting thing for me this year. But he was doing Erebus, and it adds so much more having him do it. It's so good. But I asked him who he'd have, and he did a funny bit about Roman authors, which people at home will hear soon, or will already have heard if they listen to the podcast.
James Joyce doing Ulysses, something with weird language
Yeah. And making him do that as well, you know, making him have to sit through and read it all, that would be quite good.
Yeah.
Him do that.
Like, I listened to the audio book of Clockwork Orange the other day, Anthony Burgess. Right. And of course, that's all written in Nadsat, this weird made up semi-Russian language that the Jews all do. And who was the guy that read it? Oh, he's an actor and he's British and he's... Anyway,
Hugh Grant.
No, not Hugh Grant. Okay. Younger. I think maybe, is it even the guy who does the... Oh, I'm embarrassed that I've forgotten his name because I should know it.
James McAvoy.
No, it's not a million miles away. Is maybe the guy who does the sitcom about the refugee who comes to the UK?
Yes. I hate being, and this is the worst thing about being middle aged and had two beers. I know exactly who you mean. He played Terry Jones in the Monty Python thing. I don't know him, but I follow him on Twitter, and he's a lovely guy. And
yeah,
you'll have got his name by the
Rufus Jones.
Rufus Jones.
I'm not sure it's Rufus Jones reading. This was a bad tangent. I apologize. But anyway, that was very good. Whoever reads that, it's a fairly recent one and it is brilliant. That Clockwork Orange one. What is your favorite audio book ever that you just wished it wouldn't end?
I tell you, I really loved Limmy's autobiography. His short story ones are pretty good. The first one's better than the second one of the short stories, but it's very good hearing him read that. But his autobiography is so good. I think it's sort of, he stopped doing everything now just to do Twitch like a fucking idiot would, like talking to people in his bedroom playing video games. What kind of prick would do that? But his, it's sort of so, it's a voice you don't usually hear in books, and he's so talented as a writer, I think, but it feels like, you know, Catcher in the Rye or something. You know, it just feels some of it, and then some of it's all about programming computers and stuff, which is a bit more boring. But it's his story of, or a bit less novelistic, I should say, rather. But his story of going through nearly kind of killing himself and being a massive drinker and stuff like that. And it's just the chapter about having his ejaculating for the first time. After having had a lot of trouble ejaculating, is hilarious. I was laughing and crying. It's like poetry. So I could have listened to Limmy talk about his life a lot longer, which is a sort of weird choice. But
I heard about it on Rahalastapa, and yeah. I bought it off the back of that. But then I was still writing my book at the time. And so I started listening to it, and I thought, oh, I can't listen to this because it's too good and it's going to just depress me. So I stopped listening to it, but now I'm going to go back to it now that mine is finished, although it still might be a bit depressing. Anyway, it's a different thing. He's had a colorful life. He's had a totally different background.
It's a very different life to you going to Westminster School.
Well, there you go. Yeah, exactly.
You had a different upbringing, but I'd be interested in, if you're covering that in your book, I think that's very interesting. I think Westminster's quite an interesting educational establishment, but I think to hear a reasonable person
fell over.
That doesn't happen in the live shows. To hear like a normal person who you can identify with talking about that experience, because going to public school it's not your choice. What I think is interesting about it is people judge people for going to public school, and rightly in some cases, because I can understand why they're upset, but it's never you don't choose to do that as a young person. You know, that's a choice that someone else has made for your life. And so to judge someone solely by that, I think is weird, but also it feels like Westminster's quite an interest. When I've been around it, it seems, and you and Adam and Louis Theroux all came, sorry, you and Joe and Adam, I've done the thing that they do with Double Axe, absolutely all the time. You and Joe and Louis Theroux, all came out of there, and
yes,
you're all fairly balanced and normal people.
Yeah.
Is it a slightly different one, Westminster? It's not Eton, is it, Westminster?
Oh, I see. It's like a slightly different type of public school. I think we all thought that it was. We used to take the piss out of the kind of Etonians, and we thought of them as public schoolboys. We didn't think of ourselves as public schoolboys. We thought we were normal. And, you know, because we lived in London and you couldn't really get away with, you're right in the center of London. So whenever you went out, you couldn't get away with acting like a kind of freaky toff.
No.
But then I look back at videos of myself from around then, and we were freaky toffs, kind of, but we just thought we were a bit cool. And we thought that people who went to Eton were, well, we called them, you know, it was like, oh, you go to Eton. Oh, Eton. Yeah, really great. And we'd sort of talk like that about those people as if we weren't like that ourselves. And we were kind of like that a bit, but not, I suppose, not full on. We were embarrassed about it. We were self-conscious. I think that was the thing. Being in London, there was just, you got self-conscious more quickly. So there was a lot of people at Westminster who were embarrassed about being at a posh school, and which is sort of understandable, but it's also a little bit of a shame because it was an amazing place in a lot of ways. You know, you go to prayers in Westminster Abbey every other morning, and
I love that part. I love that part of London. I love Westminster Abbey, and I've been around Westminster School a couple of times, you know, doing other things, doing charity things or whatever.
Yeah.
And it does, there does seem to be a nice feeling about it. You kind of think that would be a nice place to go to school. See, it does seem cooler, and being right. And I mean, you're opposite the Houses of Parliament, you're opposite Westminster Abbey. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is the in every sense, the privilege of being there is off the scale. But no, it's weird. So, I do write about that. And I do write about sort of feeling slightly conflicted about it and wondering why it was that my dad thought it was so important that he send his children to private schools, because it ended up ruining him financially, you know. And his life was made kind of miserable by that for a very long time. And I just thought, was it a good trade off? You know, like lots of people don't go to private school and they do fine, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah.
But you know what I mean? Though Limmy's life is very different to your life, it's sort of, again, it's so different than most people's life. It's very different than my life, even though I met a lot of public school people at university as a result of getting to Oxford, but it was, so I kind of had a taste of it, but it is, you know, it's interesting to see books written by people who have had an unusual life and a life that you don't necessarily cover elsewhere, which maybe isn't public school as much. Maybe there's a bit more public school memoirs going on than there are grown up in Glasgow. But, you know, the right person covering it, I think, is the interesting thing about that. Let's talk a little bit about, because we've been chatting away. We're nearly done. Let's talk a little. You're a fantastic podcast going from strength to strength, and absolutely, I've got people like you on my podcast, but you've got like proper people on your podcast. You've got Billy Connolly's got to be, the Billy Connolly one is superb if people haven't listened to it, but he's apart from Michael Palin, who was absolutely my number one person I wanted on, Billy Connolly's right up there. And I think, you know, he was so good.
Yeah, he was great
on the podcast, but
he was really good. I mean, I didn't really have to do very much. I just sort of sat there, and I was lucky that he was just in the right mood, but I was really quite nervous because I didn't know that much about him. You know, I wasn't a fan when I was growing up. I just didn't, I couldn't relate to him at all. I was Monty Python guy. Yeah. And Billy Connolly, there was no reference points for me whatsoever. I didn't get it. And so then I got the opportunity to talk to him because he was publishing his book of all his routines and bits and pieces. And I thought, oh, I don't know if I should, because it'll probably annoy people that I don't know his stuff well enough, and it'll be a wasted opportunity, and I don't know. And also he'll realize that I don't really know what I'm talking about, and it'll piss him off, and he might be a bit tricky, and there's too many variables. But then in the end, I thought, screw it. I'll just I'll give it a go. It's too big an opportunity to pass up.
It is.
But then the night before, I emailed a friend of mine who had worked with him, and she said, she wrote back quite a long list of things, like things to say and things not to say. I was just expecting her to say, oh, you know, like, you know, he likes, you know, don't tell jokes. He doesn't really like it when other people tell jokes. So I'm just making these up. These aren't things she said. But instead, she wrote me like a long, pretty specific list of things to avoid and things to say. And then I was just thinking, oh, shit. And I emailed my producer, Seamus, and said, look, man, I think maybe I should pull out of this. Because I don't want to fuck it up. It's just, it feels bad. It feels like I'm definitely going to fuck it up. Because one of the things she said, knowing that I'm a man who likes wearing shorts, was don't wear shorts. He hates people that wear shorts. He thinks it's pathetic for a grown man to wear shorts. And, you know, look at me. I mean... I always enjoy any opportunity to rock the creepy middle-aged DJ look. So, and it was on the hottest day of last year as well. I like wearing shorts. They're comfortable. They're practical. So that just put me in a really bad mood. I was like, what? He, fuck him. He doesn't like men who wear shorts. I'm not going to spend the afternoon. I'm not going to travel all the way down to London interviewing this guy who I don't even know his stuff particularly. And, you know, getting nasty looks because I'm wearing shorts. But actually, the fact was that by that time, I'd immersed myself in his stuff for a couple of weeks, and I got it. And it was like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. And it was amazing. And I just watched everything I could get my hands on and listened to all his albums on Spotify and the language and the cadence of it, and then the peculiarities of his own life, and watched interviews with him and found out. And it was, it was really amazing. But then that email did really make me even more nervous, because I thought, fuck, this is a complicated guy and I don't want to fuck this up. Anyway, it worked out. He was in a good mood.
It was great.
And yeah. I got there, I was wearing my shorts. I got there early because I thought I'm going to change out of my shorts. But he was fine. And I told, I said like, oh, I heard that you don't like men in shorts. And he laughed and said, who told you that? And it was good.
Like they did. And do you, well, like, so I had Michael Palin, and what, for the people who listened to this on the podcast, it'll be like 2 weeks ago.
When's it coming out?
It's coming out, like, it'll be about 6 weeks from when we're recording this. So we only did two this year. We're still working through last year. And it was like a huge deal for me. I was so jealous of you getting him. Again, you did a beautiful job with Michael.
Well, I bet yours was, I mean, I can't wait to listen to yours. I bet it was, obviously your shows are so different anyway, because they're in front of a live audience. My talk with Michael was very downbeat. It was shortly after my dad died. And I was feeling very emotional. And so it was quite a kind of, it wasn't somber, and there were some funny bits. But it certainly wasn't the kind of chat you would have in front of an audience. How was yours?
It was good. I mean, I was so in awe. I mean, he's absolutely my number one person in the world. But certainly, as a performer and writer, he's just everything. He was so nice. I wish I'd asked. I didn't really ask any emergency questions on stage.
You didn't ask him if he could suck his own cock.
I didn't ask that, but I wish I'd asked him some more, because we did something. We do like a bit backstage, as you know.
Yeah.
And he basically improvised. I asked him a question. If you're a monthly badger, it's worth watching this one. He improvised basically a whole new scene to Life of Brian. I brought up King Herod.
Wow.
And then he improvised the whole. Said, oh, we never did that, and basically improvised the whole scene that he might have done in Life of Brian. And I think I just, because I want, there was so much to cover with him, and I wanted to try and get in as much as I could, that I just, and that it was great, right? Like he was amazing. But I just sort of, I think maybe I should have been, it's always that difficult thing with my podcast, is working out that line of the respectability. Yeah. You're frozen. You look like you're frozen. I hope you're still there.
Have I unfrozen?
You know, working out how rude you have unfrozen. You're back. Is working out the how rude you can be to people and whether you can get that right. So like with Richard E. Grant, who I still don't quite understand why he or his people didn't want that one to go out. I wonder, I didn't go on enough about his major triumphs. He seemed to be enjoying it, but I was much more talking about the weirder things he'd done.
here's my theory about why he didn't want it to go out, because I think he'd been on a massive publicity push because he was in that film. Yeah. What was it called again?
Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Can You Ever Forgive Me, which is great.
And yeah, it is great.
And he was nominated for an Oscar, and it all felt right, and he was going for it, and he was doing loads of publicity. And then he didn't win, and then he just went off the map. And I don't know if the timing is right for...
I think it might have been something about that. He'd done an interview the same week it was meant to go out, I think, or around about the time they pulled it, where he'd revealed something about Julianne Moore, who had meant to have been in that film to begin with.
Right.
And so I think they were worried he might be saying stuff that affected his cash. That's the interesting thing, as that... I mean, I'm just guessing, because honestly... Top three podcasts, I would say, of everyone I've done. He was brilliant. It was very funny. I was cheeky to him, but I felt it. He appreciated it and he worked with it. I think that maybe if I'd just even done 5 minutes, I went, oh, you've worked with Robert Altman, you've done this and you've done that, must have been amazing. I think he would have, maybe, I don't know. But anyway, so I think maybe with Michael Palin, I kind of wish I'd been, because he's, you know, you sort of respect him so much, but he's still, like, you know, it's not like he's not a man who is not rude. It's not like a man who you couldn't ask if you ever sucked your own cock. No, yeah. I felt like that would be a wrong thing. He wrote Every Sperm Is Sacred. But, yeah, it was great. It was interesting. And he talked a little bit, you know, he talked about Terry Jones a little bit, but not too much. I kind of didn't want to push that too much. I didn't want to make him cry or make myself cry. Although it was interesting, he talked about... having marred, not quite fallen out with him, but they were such good friends. But when Ripping Yarns came out, because the BBC were trying to push it as his thing, as Michael Palin's thing, they didn't really want two pythons involved. So Terry's role in it was kind of, you know, even though they obviously wrote it together, uh-huh, was kind of a little bit underplayed. And I think Terry Jones was a bit put out by it. So he did talk about that, which is, again, quite interesting, because, I mean, I'm fascinated by that double act dynamic and how that works, and how you, if you remain friends or whether you don't remain friends, or if you ever were friends. But with that, with those two, I mean, certainly that, all the tributes that Michael did to Terry is just, and him going to see him at his house,
yeah,
and still take him to the pub every week even though he didn't know who he was,
yeah.
No, it's so moving and beautiful, kind of this beautiful male friendship that's quite a rare thing, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Louis, I sent Louis... I'm just going to make it about myself again, if that's all right.
Okay, do. Yeah.
yeah, because I watched Michael Palin talking about Terry Jones and choking up on the news. And it was, yeah, and I'm sure, like a lot of people, just started crying myself watching that clip. Yeah. But I sent my book to Louis Theroux to read, because he's in it as well. And but Louis described it as a kind of love story, but you know, it's the story of my love affair with Joe,
yeah,
from charting it from the beginning. And I do sort of write about it explicitly, not explicitly in a sexual sense, although there is some very hot sex with Joe that is described. But yeah, it just, you know, that thing when you look back on it, you think like, oh gosh, yeah. It is a love affair, really, just without the sex. And everything about it is the same. You know, the feeling of excitement you get when you're going to see the person, the feeling of missing them so much when they're not around, and imagining the kind of things that they would say if they were there, and sort of laughing at the things that you imagine them saying. You can hear their voice so clearly. All that sort of stuff, you know, as well as admiring them and being inspired by them. And anyway, so I hope I've kind of done some justice to that. And then at the end, there's a few sort of moments as well when I don't really touch on negative stuff too much, but there's a couple of moments when I just thought, what's going on here, and where it felt like our friendship was kind of dissolving or whatever, towards the end of the 80s. And I never really resolved any of those things. But then I did a sort of bonus podcast thing with Joe just the other day, a remote thing that's going to go at the end of the audiobook. Yeah. And he picked out various bits and pieces from the book, and he picked out one of the things I wrote about. And we talked about that. And we sort of resolved it at the end of the book. So that was quite satisfying.
But I think it's got that element of marriage to it, and like some marriages, as we were discussing earlier, are very harmonious, and some are based on. And I think that's what, and you know, I think in Monty Python, I talked to him about. I think the heart of Monty Python was John Cleese and Terry Jones, kind of not really getting on that well. I think Terry Jones and John Cleese rubbed each other up so much that was the grit in the oyster that created the pearl. You know, I think that they came at it from such a different angle and had such different talents. I mean, the thing with Monty Python, it's an amazing group of people, and Terry Jones is sort of the heart of it. And again, it takes realizing, you know, looking back at it to kind of realize that as much. But I think without him antagonizing John Cleese, I think it probably, and vice versa, I don't think it'd be quite what it was. And so I think, you know, with me and Stu, I think there was always, you know, the competitive, it was more like that competitive thing that you can get in a marriage where you're more fighting, and then that leads to fantastic sex or comedy, hopefully.
Yeah.
But there's loads of things that, you know, I saw, there's an incident that I've never talked about and I've never talked to Stu about. And this came very, very early on it was sort of weird, because at university I was sort of I'd been sort of fated as the main performer, and sure. I'd done the Oxford Review and all this sort of stuff, and he'd written it. And there was a sort of weird thing with that. And then when we came into the real world, he was doing much better as a stand-up and I wasn't. And he was seen as the performer and I was seen as the writer, and it sort of all kind of flipped around. And I really wanted to act. And he got this, he got offered this part in like a student short film. It was like nothing. It wasn't important, but it was a short film in which I can't remember what happened, but it ended up with him going around to a guy's house. And then they ended up on this date together and they sort of danced together.
I love that film.
I can't remember what it was called. John Maloney did it in the end. I should have talked to John Maloney about it. And I kind of thought, at the time I thought, it's kind of weird that, you know, that he's in a double act, and this is, it would seem obvious to sort of offer me the other part. But, and I think I even said to Stu, oh, that's, you know, it's weird you got offered that and I didn't get offered it. He said, yeah, well, that you didn't get offered it. So, and then it was in Norwich, actually, fun enough. We were doing a gig in Norwich and they had the after show part. They had like, they'd filmed it in Norwich, and then there was a party where all the crew got together. And one of the crew said to me, so you didn't fancy doing the film then? And this is an interesting story, because obviously we'd both been offered it. I never got told that I'd been offered it. Stu said, I'll do it, but not if he's doing it, obviously. This was very early on. But I also just went, in that moment, I went, yeah, no, didn't fancy it. So like I didn't even, and I never told Stu that I knew that he'd done that. But that's such, you know, he didn't want to be an actor and I really wanted to be an actor. And that was a really weird little power play going on between the two of us. But the reason I tell the story is I think it says as much about me as it does about him, because I was in such a kind of low status position by then that I didn't even go, what the fuck? Why did you do? You know, I just thought, and I never, ever even told him that I knew that that had happened. I never spoke to anyone about it. And, you know, I could have said to the guy, oh, yeah, I didn't know. You know, no one told me about it. But that's kind of interesting, isn't it? And I'm sure he could come up with some stories where I did something similar to him. I doubt it. I'm a very nice guy. But I was just been thinking about it. And that's such, it just sums up that the weirdness at the heart of our relationship, even then, you know. So sort of fascinates. It fascinates me when a double act we were friends, but I think working together made it harder to be friends, and then stopping working together made it easier to be friends.
Were you friends before you started working together?
I mean, we met and then decided to work together, but we were certainly friendly to begin with. But I think it all kind of came down to, it was a weird thing, because I did the Oxford Review and he didn't, but it was the Oxford Review that got really pummeled by all the stand-up comedians in Edinburgh. Like, I had a terrible time and basically nearly stopped performing. And he wasn't part of it because he wasn't in it. And then he really got into stand-up. And then, so right at the beginning of our sort of professional relationship, he was pushing more to be a stand-up and I wanted to do sketch comedy and felt resentful of all these people who'd bullied me. And he was sort of siding with all those people. So it immediately created this, you know, this divide between us that was a little bit weird. But I think, again, I think that was what made it work as well.
Yeah.
As a double act. But yeah, I mean, I'm glad, you know, I think it ended at the right time, and I would never want to go back to it, which is, you know, I think is different than, say, you and Joe, who still sort of seem happily to get together when you do get together.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's good now. I really like it. There's not a shred of envy or, you know, bitterness left. I can say that with my hand on my heart. Which side is it? There you go. but yeah, there definitely was for a while. Oh, it was grim. I wrote a big thing in for the book all about when we did a toy movie of Toytanic. Do you remember?
Yeah, like
we used to do parodies of TV shows and films in our TV show with little stuffed toys and stuff. And when we did the, I think it was the second series, it was 1998 or something like that. And two series of our show had gone out, and we were out in California staying with the people that produced our show that ran the production company, Fenton and Randy, they were called. And we were kind of on top of the world, and it was like we'd made it. We had two shows. They'd gone down really well. They'd gotten pretty good ratings for what it was. We got some good reviews. It was like, yes, we're the kings of the fucking world. And so we went out to California, and they hired this skiing lodge out in Mammoth Mountain. We went skiing, and we were out on a hot tub, me and Joe, out on a balcony overlooking the mountains. And we're just like, this is it. We're the kings. I was drinking a beer, and I think Joe was smoking a doobie, and we were just, it was the sort of Hollywood moment of success. And I was playing around with my empty beer bottle. It was bobbing around in the hot tub. And I sort of said something like, iceberg right ahead. And I knocked. And Joe said, yeah, we should do Titanic as a toy movie. And I was like, I don't know about that. And as soon as he said it, I just thought, oh, fucking hell, he's gonna do Titanic, and it's gonna be really good, and it's obviously it's gonna be brilliant because everyone's seen fucking Titanic, and he's gonna do a really good job. And sure enough, he absolutely went to town, because the thing that we never admitted really was that we used to divvy up all the toy movies. We always said like we did everything absolutely together because we wanted to maintain a coherent image, you know, of just like, yeah, we share all the responsibilities. But actually, for practical reasons, apart from anything else, we divided everything up. So it was really competitive, like who's done the best toy movie and stuff. And yeah, it was generally Joe that did the best ones, I can see now. And so he went completely to town on this fucking Titanic thing. And I went on holiday. I just met my beautiful wife, although we weren't married at that point. And we went away for our first foreign holiday. And when we got back, I went into the studio, and the entire studio was filled with this 8-foot fucking cardboard model of Titanic that Joe had made with all cardboard and straws. And it was completely amazing. And I thought, this is bad. And I was going to, I mean, I really had to stop myself from breaking in there at night and just burning it. And basically I had fuck all to do with Toytanic. I did the voices on it. Like we came together and do voices and things like that. And then it was just everyone loved Toytanic. You know, it came out in Channel 4. They did Film 4. They launched the Film 4 channel. And on the launch night, they showed a sort of 10-minute cut of Toytanic. And everyone was going, oh, it's so amazing. It's so brilliant. And every time someone said it, I would just go, yeah, fucking yeah, it's really good, isn't it? Yeah, it's great. And then, but we were saying, you know, to everyone, oh, we do everything together. We do everything together. And then Time Out rang up just before the Film 4 launch night. And they said, oh, we just wanted to just chat with you quickly about the Toytanic thing. And so I was thinking, well, you're phoning the wrong guy, but I can't say that because we're supposed to do everything. I can't say, oh, you need to talk to Joe. He did that one. So I had to just sort of style it out and say, oh yeah, what do you want to know? And I thought I was very careful to say we about everything. we did this and we did that, and, you know, and trying to do justice to what Joe had done on it and all that. Anyway, obviously, an eye must have slipped through. And the next, like when Time Out came out that week, I got a phone call, and it was Joe, and he was apoplectic. And he just said, "What the fuck have you said now?" And I was like, "What? What are you on about?" And he said, "You're talking, you basically made out that you did Titanic in the thing." I mean, it's so just incredibly ludicrous and pathetic, but the tensions and the lack of perspective at the time is just so overwhelming. Anyway, I wrote a big story about it, but then it was one of the pieces that I eventually just chopped out of the book. It's less about all that stuff, and it's more about the kind of fun times.
Yeah, yeah, which there were as well. But for
oh,
me,
man, there was loads. Yeah,
but it's you know, it's fascinating, I think, and it's the way any friendship goes, and the way if you meet someone, especially when you were very young when you met Joe, obviously, but. And I think what's also, which I read today in an interview with Joe, is that you basically got him into the first TV thing that you'd been offered a TV thing and got Joe into it. So there's always that weird dynamic where someone has to be grateful for the opportunity, which he obviously still is. But then, you know, then you,
yes,
know, you can't last forever.
Right. You start out as the senior partner.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
At various points, you want to just say, "Can I just can I just remember how this started? Like how all this started? Is that with me, because I'm special. I'm the special guy, not you so much." In that voice, and then you know the dynamic is constantly shifting, and oh, it's so exhausting. I wish I could go back. That was the overwhelming thing. Writing the book was at certain points just wishing more than anything I could go back and just say, "Mate, calm down and don't do that."
But then I just think the way we took things so seriously, and everything was so important. We'd argue over whether "at" or "the" was in a sentence for a day. You know, it was nuts. But that level, that you need that level, certainly at that stage, I think you need that level of passion and self-belief. You know, I was so this weird mixture of insecurity and utter confidence. You know, I mean, it's such a weird job being a comedian to believe that you deserved any of those things that either of us had in the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, but as well as going home and thinking, "Oh no, you know, I'm terrible at everything I do." So, you know, it's a bizarre thing, and it's very difficult to navigate those waters, and especially with someone you know very well and things, you know, and your motivations and what you want to have, it changes. It's sort, to me, it's just amazing. Those double acts, the double acts that keep working forever and that haven't fought, you know, there's ones that work together and don't like each other, but still are forced to work with each other, which is interesting because they're so successful, they can't stop. And there's those like Terry and Michael and Dawn and Jennifer, I guess, and who are just like absolutely best friends.
Yeah. Vic and Bob and people like that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, I find it very interesting, and but it's only because I think it's like being brothers, it's like being lovers, it's like being best friends. You know, for anyone, it still matches up. I think it's an understandable relationship to anyone, because everyone has got that relationship with someone in their life. It's someone they work with, someone who's in their family, someone they have had a relationship with, or were in a relationship with, or are still in a relationship with.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, and I think in the 90s and the early 2000s. The women I chose, or who chose me, I don't know, you know, were always inappropriate, not always, but nearly always wrong and bullying, and, you know, and took advantage of me being nice. And I wasn't always nice either, but, you know, it was, I would always have a certain type. So you're making certain choices in your life about who you're interacting with. And I think with women, I kind of went, yeah, I'm not going to ever go in a relationship with someone like that ever again. And I think that's what you realize, you know, you realize that as we go on. Anyway, look, we've taken a lot of your time.
That is my wife texting me.
Is that your wife? My wife hasn't texted me yet to tell me it's over.
She, I mean, this podcast. Saying, "Have you finished?"
We've gone on longer than we said we would.
Finishing. There we go.
So anyway, look, I really hope I can get you Adam, no, Joe.
Yes.
The other one.
No, we were really looking forward to it.
Looking forward to it.
Let's make it happen.
Shame. Yeah, so we'll do it again at some other time, and I'll see how he feels about all of this.
He might not be talking to me after this, after I told the Titanic story.
Yeah, maybe. Ramble book out in September.
The physical book is out in September. The idea is for the audio book to come out in a few weeks. I suggested to my publishers and said, like, well, why don't we just put the audio book out now? I mean,
good idea.
And so that's what we're going to do, I think.
Great. Good. And the podcast is back and continuing. What fantastic guests that I'll be jealous of have you got coming up, or are you not allowed to say?
Well, it's all scrambled now because of the thing.
But you can do them remote. You're not going to do them remote. I mean, it works for you remotely, and this has worked very well, I think, remotely, you and I.
Yeah, it's so different, though. It's so different to being... I really need to be in a room. The only one I ever did remotely before this whole crisis was Bill Hader. And I liked... And it was good, but I felt as if it would have been a lot better if I'd been in a room with him. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's difficult, but, and so that's why I'm leaning on old friends and people I already have a relationship with. So repeat guests. So Joe will probably do one, if he's still talking to me after this, and, Louis through, I hope, and Tash Dimitriou and past podcast guests who I already know I'm going to do, I think.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much for being my first remote guest. It's
been very thanks, man. Good to
thanks
see
to
you.
Yeah, really love to see you. Take care, and let's hope we both get through this alive. One of us is going to die. I mean, I've got young kids. I hope it's you, just because I've got young kids. That's the
yeah. Thing. Look, my book's finished. I've had a great run. Thanks very much. Bye.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, Adam Buxton. Hooray. Thanks, Adam. We're going to go. Thanks to everyone who's listened and watched and subscribed. Subscribe and do whatever you like. Now, fuck off. Goodbye. Thank you, Adam. Bye-bye. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Adam Buxton. Thank you to Pest for playing this music, even in lockdown, though Pests are part of the problem. Am I right? They must be regretting that name now. I am indebted and would like to thank... Adam especially, and for being the first guest. Everyone at Zencaster and Zoom for helping us do this. Everyone at Twitch for giving us the chance to do this. And especially, of course, to Chris Evans, not that one, who is doing not only all the behind-the-scenes work of setting this up, but essentially being now the super producer of the show. So I am very indebted to him. Our executive producer of this show was the wonderful Martin Deet. We called him Martin Details on the set, me and Adam. He's all into the deets, that's what we would say about him. It's a clever pun. Also, we called him House Martin as well sometimes. That was another name we gave to him. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz at GoFasterStrike.com production. Why not head to GoFasterStrike.com/badges and become a monthly badger? Help us raise some funds to keep making podcasts and get a cavalcade of lovely extras for yourself, including a lovely shiny badge or two and a membership card and lots of backstage interviews. All right, my fan friends, I will see you on the other side of this terrible atrocity. Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.